From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
And they told us she would probably be a vegetable and unable to walk, talk, or eat. She's now in third grade. And she's in a typical classroom. She's able to do everything. And it's all because of early intervention.
We either balance the budget by raising taxes and revenue, or we balance the budget by borrowing money. I would like to have the conversation about revenue. I would like to have the conversation about what we can agree on.
Let's have a discussion about the budget. Let's put everything else aside and talk about the budget. Talk about that. And we should be able to do that without it being marred and wrapped in a conversation about structural reforms.
So today we just heard there's a financial transaction tax we should have, and there's these amorphous corporate loopholes. Bring the bills. Bring them. Put them on the board. That shouldn't be too hard for the party in charge of this legislature, this entire chamber and the other chamber. If you want to put a tax, put it on the board. And let's duke it out, and let's see who's who in the zoo and where things lie.
Pull up your slacks, max your tax, and let's find out who's who in the zoo. Illinois government slow motion shutdown continues. That was Republican State Representative Ron Sandag auditioning to write the next Dr. Seuss book. Before that, we heard from State Representatives Will Davis, a Democrat, and Republican Mike Tryon. We also heard from Toni Markham, who was part of a rally at the State House on behalf of the early intervention program she says was so helpful to her daughter. We'll talk about that and more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. Bill Wheelhouse is away. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Jamie Dunn, editor of Illinois Issues Magazine, which is now part of Illinois Public Radio, and from WBEZ in Chicago, Tony Arnold. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And Jamie, thanks for being on as well.
Glad to be here.
All right, so this is yet another week. We're approaching 3 months now without the budget. I feel like, you were not hearing last week's show. This is a new show. But once again, no real movement. House Democrats put up a couple of bills, one in committee, one on the floor, to try and fund some programs. They advanced one out of committee, one sort of in a preliminary phase on the House floor, but no final votes on these taken this week. I guess, Tony, I'm going to start with you. We're not seeing much progress on the state budget, right? I mean, we're still kind of treading water here.
Right. As far as I know, there's still not been a meeting among all of the leaders in Springfield to sort of work out any sort of deal. The closest thing that we're getting anymore, if you even want to call it close, is that the House of Representatives voted yet again on a property tax freeze, which the governor says is one of the issues that needs to pass before he'll talk about this budget process. But this property tax freeze, this is by some counts it's been called so many times people are losing count. It's some counts 15, some counts 16 times this bill's been called, and it did not advance any more than it already has before. So I'm struggling to find new things to say. There's nothing new here, but I think that there, week to week, there's just new things that you're hearing about what's getting funded or what's not getting funded, and that's where the courts are coming in.
And Jamie, we've heard Senate Democrats have been talking a lot about this, about how much of state government is being funded now, right? Estimates are 90%. I've even heard some people saying 95% of the money is going out, except we're spending on a pace that is a lot higher than we're going to have money for.
Absolutely. And it's basically two areas that are not currently being funded, which is higher education and then social services that aren't covered by all these consent decrees. So social services that aren't tied to federal funding or Medicaid. And the way we are spending, if something isn't resolved, they're really going to be on the hook for money running out in these two big areas, you know, still needing funds and nothing being there for them.
Yeah. And Charlie, I don't know. I feel like we're just having the same conversation week after week here.
Well, to quote a great American who passed away last week, it's deja vu all over again, as Lawrence Peter Berra would say.
Yeah, Yogi Berra.
Mm-hmm. Except it gets more dire every week because, as Jamie said, we're spending at a certain level. And we're spending last year's level for those programs that are covered either through a court order or a consent decree or through statutes that require the money to go out regardless. But what that means is that the programs that aren't being covered, there's nothing left for them. And ultimately, when we run out of money, you're going to have zero funding for higher education or some of these other things that are kind of slipping through the cracks, if you will. And one real concern, as we've talked about before, is how about low-income college students? The colleges more or less have floated loans to the students, assuming that at some point the monetary assistance program, the state's major grant program to help kids from poorer families get a college education, that at some point the state will fund it. So I'm a low-income kid. I'm here at UIS. Our financial aid office says, well, we'll figure out your financial aid and we'll include that MAP grant for you. We'll pretend the money's there. What happens if it's not there? And the universities have said, come spring semester, we're not going to be able to do this. And to me, that's one of the real tragedies. Kids who are trying to get ahead, a lot of them, first time anybody in their family has gone to college, and now suddenly they may be on the hook. And by definition, they can't afford it or they wouldn't get the grant in the first place.
Tony, you were trying to get in there?
Yeah, on this issue of like how, what is the breaking point? There is one thing that I'd say that did come out of a court hearing this week where, again, there's Medicaid has had more court hearings, whether this what level the state is funding Medicaid, how much it has to pay for Medicaid, should it fund Medicaid? These are some of the main questions that have been in front of a federal judge multiple times since June or July now. One new thing that did come out this week was how long can this go on for? And not only that, but then if the state runs out of money, what happens? And one attorney tried to argue that, well, a federal court order would trump anything that the state appropriated on its own. The theory there being there's a court order saying the state must fund Medicaid, and there's the state legislature approved funding for schools. If those two things come to a head, the court order is going to trump whatever is going toward schools. The other side, for the attorney general who's representing the state, was basically saying, I don't know that it's an either or situation where Medicaid or schools are getting funded. I think that there's just going to be a backlog of bills that just keeps going and going and going, and we go further into debt as a state. And if you play this out, if you go all the way to June 30th and we make it through the entire year with no budget, it's just going to be a bigger deficit. That's the deal.
That's assuming that providers are still willing to pay those service or to provide those services for no money. We heard Secretary of State Jesse White sent a letter to the governor this week where he was saying that, you know, he's worried about people that provide electricity to the Capitol complex, for example, are maybe going to shut the power off at the Capitol building. I mean, this is... Yeah.
Yeah, we also saw a story from the State Journal Register that the vendors providing food to veterans' homes are saying, we don't know how much longer we can continue to provide the food. You know, all these folks that provide services or goods to the state have just been kind of floating the state so far. They're used to getting paid late because the state's been behind on payments for years. But at some point, you know, they may not want to have so much uncertainty, and they're used to getting paid late with a budget, knowing that that money is appropriated to them and coming at some point. We're in a different situation here where there isn't an appropriation. They can't be certain, you know, what's going to get funded, what's going to get paid. So it's a level of uncertainty that these vendors haven't dealt with before. It seems like they've been willing to kind of be patient with the state so far, but we are hearing news this week, and that's maybe the biggest budget development. We're seeing these little kind of cracks of vendors saying, wait a minute, I don't know if we're going to keep doing this.
You know, Charlie, I wanted to ask you, we're kind of approaching in Washington, D.C., the possibility of another federal government shutdown. And when the federal government shuts down, people take notice. I remember I was doing news stories about that last time it happened. The, you know, tourist exhibits closed. There were veterans, World War II veterans, breaking down the barricades to go see the World War II Veterans Memorial on the National Mall in Washington. Yet here in Illinois, the governor has sort of taken steps to avoid the appearance of a state shutdown, right? He approved the education budget. He himself went to court to get state employees paid and argued on behalf of judges stepping in to make sure state employees get paid. I wonder, have we in the media, you know, the analysts, the pundits, whatever you want to say, sort of, you know, there are people for whom government is shutting down, right? And these are the social service agencies. I mean, have we done maybe not the best job of framing this discussion here in Illinois and giving the impression that, you know, everything is kind of limping along when really for some areas of government, this is a real crisis?
Yeah, I think part of it is that in looking at the big picture, you talk about the things that are being funded. And for example, while on a personal level, not having money for early childhood intervention is a real tragedy, and it's going to have drastic effects on folks who otherwise would have this diagnosis and screening for their infants that need services early on to be able to lead productive lives. On the other hand, that while it's intensely personal and tragic for that particular family, it doesn't strike the broad populace in the same way that, for example, had the governor vetoed the budget for elementary and secondary education, as he did all the rest of the budget the Democrats sent him, and the schools didn't open, well, that would affect literally millions of people. And so the consequences are very dire, but they're for a relatively small population, and therefore it kind of gets overlooked or glossed over. But now, as you were alluding to, for example, if City Water, Light, and Power, our local municipal utility, decides, okay, we are no longer going to provide electric service or water service to not just the state capitol, but all the government facilities in Springfield, that would get people's attention.
Yeah. I have a hard time imagining that happening, but, you know, who knows? We are in uncharted waters here.
Yeah, and all these providers, at some point, they have to say to themselves, do I want to keep, in essence, floating the state of Illinois? And one of the kind of ironies is Jamie alluded to the fact that we had these huge backlogs. Well, for the first several months of this fiscal year, vendors were getting paid, but it was because of spending authorized for last fiscal year that we were just behind in paying the bills.
So vendors have built in anywhere from 1, 2, 3, even as many as 5, 6, 7, 8 months into their delayed payment cycle based on the past years of experience with the state. But eventually
sure,
that's going
to... Sure, but with the expectation that, well, there'll be a new budget in place and I may have to wait another 6 months, but ultimately I'll get it. Now there is no new budget, so there's no guarantee that the services that I'm providing today, I will get paid sooner or later.
Yeah. So you mentioned, Charlie, early intervention there. There was also a rally at the State House this week. This is one of the programs that now is getting paid. But, you know, there are still others that aren't. There was a lot of people in the rotunda wearing yellow shirts. One of the things that struck me, you know, I think there's a stereotype out there of the type of people who benefit from government services. You know, you can think back to Mitt Romney's comment about the 47% and, you know, this idea of people who take from government. This was a very middle class group of people. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about what early intervention does, for example, as a program.
Well, basically, it's a program that's designed to test infants to see if they're prone to certain developmental disabilities. And if they are, to get them services to help them develop at, I guess, a regular pace. And it's proven effective. And the proponents say that if you can get a child early on who is going to have maybe learning problems later on in school, if you can work with that child, help the child reach the appropriate developmental level, you're going to save a lot of money on down the road. But it's like so many other social programs. You have to pay kind of a little bit immediately to save long-term costs.
Yeah. Well, and they actually, Tony, I think last week they became part of a federal court or one of these, the controller sort of retroactively decided that they were covered by a consent decree.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about early intervention is that for a lot of services where the courts have intervened, the services have had to take the state to court and have a federal judge say, yes, this is part of the consent decree. Yes, we must pay Medicaid. Yes, we must pay foster care. Those had to be basically taken in front of a judge. What's interesting is that with early intervention is that the comptroller single singled that one out and just said, this, we think this is part of the consent decree. Nobody, it didn't go so far as to appear in front of a judge. That she just said, we think this is included, so therefore we're going to start funding it, and vouchers can come in to us and we'll pay them out, without a judge saying, yes, that early intervention needs to be a part of this consent decree, which you can debate whether that would have been an issue or not. We saw one issue, another issue where with seniors getting services at their homes rather than at a nursing home. There was a debate over whether that was in a consent decree or not, whether that was fell under a court order. And there was really like very little of a fight. The judge basically said, yeah, okay, give me the order and I'll sign it. And I imagine early intervention would have been the same, would have looked like a similar process where the judge doesn't want to be the one to say, you know what? No, that one service, no, that's not, that doesn't really belong in this.
Well, and that in-home service for seniors, that's another good example of what I was saying before. From a financial point of view, it's a lot cheaper for the state to have somebody come and make me lunch and maybe help me clean the house than it is to put me in a nursing home. And obviously for the individual, to the extent that someone can maintain themselves in their own residence in familiar surroundings, it's much better for them emotionally, physically, and it's just the right thing to do, in my judgment. And over the years, we've moved in that direction under governors and lawmakers of both parties, because it's the proper level of care for people, plus it saves us a lot of money.
Jamie, and we saw a couple of bills in the House this week. We talked about that briefly earlier to sort of fund some of these programs. We heard a Republican at the top of the show who said, you know, it's time to talk about revenue. He said, there's two ways we can get out of this. We can extend our debt or we can raise taxes. Interesting that he didn't mention we could also make cuts, because a lot of people have said that that's part of this, but maybe that wasn't politically popular thing to say. Maybe it just slipped his mind. I don't know. But I mean, no real movement here. I mean, this is, you know, he said it's time to talk about revenue. There were some people who kind of latched onto that as a hopeful sign this week. Does that make you any more optimistic that things are moving?
No, when listening to that committee, you know, when you take it into the context of the entirety of what he said, I interpreted it more as saying that we can't spend this money, this legislation that was about $4 billion that went to or would go to a lot of social services that aren't being funded. I took it more as him saying, we don't have the money for this. We have to decide where the money would be coming from before we pass an appropriation promising, you know, the funding to these programs, not necessarily him calling for a tax increase, although there, you know, does seem to be the tone around a tax increase does seem to have shifted in the last year or so, as far as more folks maybe realizing that that's something that might be needed, or at least there's less of a heated debate over it. As you said, in the past, we've always heard folks kind of pipe up and say, also, we need cuts. And we're not hearing that as much. When this bill was in committee, a lot of the Republicans said, well, I don't really oppose funding any of these programs. We just don't have the money.
Yeah. All right. Coming up, Chicago turns to Springfield. This is State Week. Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Jamie Dunn, and Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold. I'm Brian Mackey. Tony, Chicago, the mayor, we've talked about this for the past couple of weeks, has a big property tax increase he's trying to get through, but he needs some help from Springfield to get that done.
You're great. Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced his budget plans for the next year for the city of Chicago, and the bottom line of his overall proposal is that he's looking at Chicago's about to get a lot more expensive to live in the city. It's a variety of increases on fees, and in particular the big one is the property taxes. But on the fees side, we're talking about an increase in price on garbage collection, taxes on e-cigarettes. Getting in a cab would there'd be an automatic fee that would be a little bit more expensive there. Fees for Uber or these ride sharing companies if they go to the airports. Privatizing the 311, so if you call and say, hey, I got graffiti on my garage, that'd be going that outsourced to a private company. So there's all these different things that he's proposing, but the big one is a big property tax increase, and he needs basically two things from Springfield. One is a pension bill that it's actually already passed and is on hold. It was a procedural move was put on by this bill by Senate President John Cullerton a while ago. And this bill is for police officers and firefighters, their pensions. And it was actually agreed upon by the unions. One of the few things, one of these, when you hear about the pension discussions, the unions actually are okay with this bill because it relies on revenue in part from a Chicago casino that doesn't yet exist. So it relies on that. But the mayor's budget does rely on that bill eventually getting passed. Now, I assume that's he's waiting for some sort of deal from Democrats and the governor on that. The other element that Emanuel needs from Springfield is part of his property tax proposal is we'll raise taxes on most people, but if your home is worth less than $250,000 in the city, then you can be exempt over this over 4 years. So those are the two elements, and he even sent his deputy mayor, Steve Koch, to go testify to a House committee. But what's interesting about that is that they didn't have a proposal to look at. They just kind of were listening to him explain the basics of what they're looking for here.
Yet another example of a lot of discussion in Springfield, not a lot of action yet. Charlie, maybe you can speak a little bit to, I mean, Chicago property taxes are actually a pretty good deal right now if you're a resident as compared to the rest of the state.
Yeah, the property tax rate in Chicago is among the lowest of any municipality in the city of Illinois or in the state of Illinois. And, for example, there are some towns in the south suburbs where the property tax rate is triple or quadruple what it is in the city of Chicago. And the tax bills are higher in the sense that the property is not worth as much as property, say, in Lincoln Park or one of the trendy neighborhoods of Chicago.
Well, right. So you have in the south suburbs, you might have, you know, your biggest property tax base at one time was a thriving factory that's now a burned out shell of a factory, whereas you've got the Sears Tower,
costs. Yeah. And the way it works is that the property tax, your individual property tax bill is based on the value of your property in relation to all the other property within the taxing district. And that value was a calculation done to raise from the tax base the amount of money that's being asked for in property taxes. And the result of that division is the rate. And so Chicago's rate has been low. Plus, in the city of Chicago, residential property is assessed at, I believe, 10% of its fair market value. Everywhere else outside of Cook County, property taxes require that the value of the property be set at 33 1/3% of fair market value. So there's a break that way, although the state does come in and apply a factor to try and raise the overall assessment level up. The bottom line, though, for the mayor's plan would be not to reduce property taxes overall, but rather to shift a portion of the burden off of homeowners and put it onto the business community. He's still asking for the same amount of money, but that portion of the tax base that is made up of residential property is going to be artificially have its value lowered because of this increased homestead exemption.
So, Tony, as you mentioned, to get that done, it's got to come through Springfield. That also potentially means getting the governor's signature on board. If the House and Senate aren't going to override him on it. We know that the governor and mayor have a long relationship, but it's not exactly been super productive since the governor took office and started pushing his turnaround agenda.
There's a lot politically going on here. One is that I think you should know that, first off, like, for all the budget talk that we have going on in Springfield, the Chicago City Council is not at all that. And I think the mayor's proposal, the budget, would have support from aldermen to pass. That said, because it's relying on this element from Springfield, that's complicating like the practicalities of what's in the actual budget plan. We've heard from Senate President John Cullerton, who said that he's supporting the mayor and the mayor's proposal on this. The House Speaker, Michael Madigan, has had issues with the pension idea, particularly when it comes to schools, over whether that should be picked up by the state or continue to be paid for by the city. And that's been a big issue between the two of them as this has worked out. Then you have the factor of where Governor Rauner stands in all of this whole picture. And part of this what's going on here between the Democrats and the Republicans in Springfield? Where Chicago fits in here might actually be where you get something of a compromise or something of agreed ground here, where one side's able to say, okay, we'll give you this half if you can give us this half. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch how this part, how the Chicago budget ideas play out politically, because I think that might be where you actually get something of the sides sitting down and agreeing on things. For whatever reason, it might actually take the city's budget instead of the state's budget to get them to sit down. That said, we've heard the governor say that he still wants limitations on collective bargaining in the city of Chicago, and that's something that the mayor and Democrats have not been willing to concede to. So it's going to be interesting to see what that looks like.
And I think another interesting angle in terms of this exemption for homesteads that the mayor wants as part of his budget plan, if I'm a downstate legislator or a suburban legislator, I might say to myself, why should I vote to give a tax break to homeowners in the city of Chicago when there are struggling homeowners in my own community, in my district, who would love to see a doubling of the property tax exemption, the reduction in the assessed value of their home?
And I heard that very thing from Representative Mike Zaleski, who's a Democrat from Riverside, Chicago suburb, that, yeah, exactly. His homeowners are kind of aching under the property taxes. He says as he's going around collecting signatures, as all House members are doing right now to run for re-election, or the ones who are running for re-election anyway, is that they are feeling that's the number one complaint, he said, that he's hearing, are property taxes.
Well, and that's as Tony suggested, that may be an area for compromise where instead of just applying to Chicago, we'll apply it across the state, and that will bring us in some downstate and suburban votes, maybe Republicans too, in favor of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've only got about a minute left. Jamie, I wanted to ask you, we saw another high-level departure from the Rauner administration this week.
We did. This is the second time we've seen a director of an agency leave pretty early in Rauner's term to see folks, you know, already exiting. The director of the Department of Agriculture, who was, I believe, an Illinois native and a farmer, Phil Nelson, has resigned. Reportedly, the Rauner administration asked him to resign. And the State Fair Administrator, and Brian, you may have to help me with the pronunciation, Patrick Buchan.
Is how it's going. Yeah.
Also headed to the exit, saying that he could not stay in the job if the director had left, because he felt like he owed the he owed the director for his job and was very loyal to him. So he left as well, had some very negative parting words for the administration. There's a lot of rumors swirling around what's going on. We don't really know. I haven't done any reporting on this. It's a fairly new news, but it's another person exiting fairly early in the administration's term.
Yeah, you're too polite. I believe his quote that he said to the State Journal Register here in Springfield was that it was political crap. So hopefully nobody needed their fainting couches for that. That is our time for this edition of State Week. Thank you to Charlie Wheeler and our guests, Jamie Dunn of Illinois Issues and Tony Arnold of Chicago Public Radio Station WBEZ. You can get a podcast of this show at WUIS.org. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.